You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, eating at restaurants has gotten a lot noisier over the years. We'll look at how restaurant designs have changed and why a loud space might actually be more profitable. First, state Republicans are getting ready to take up several GOP-friendly bills, including some designed to limit the power of incoming Governor Tony Evers. Among the proposals are limits to the window for early voting, moving up the 2020 presidential primary, keeping Evers from changing the state's voter ID law, and eliminating his ability to pull Wisconsin out of a federal lawsuit against Obamacare. Evers reacted to the plans during a news conference yesterday, calling it an embarrassment to the state.
The entire package is an effort on the part of the Republican majority to take us back to November 6th and hopefully change that that result.
A public committee hearing on the session started earlier today. Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Ron.
So this hearing was scheduled. It got bumped back a little bit for a press conference. What kind of things are we hearing from Republican leaders on why they're bringing in this package of changes?
A couple things stand out from Assembly Speaker Robin Boss and Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. For Fitzgerald, it was when he said, you know, I want to be clear, I am concerned, I'm worried about what Governor Governor-elect Evers is going to do in the state. He's worried about the direction that Evers is going to take the state. And so Fitzgerald says this is all part of that process. This lame duck session is part of that process. He views this as, that this legislature and this governor are in office until early January, and that they are exercising the power that they have afforded to them. Speaker Voss framed it as an exercise where he is giving the legislature more power over the executive, that the executive has accumulated too much power over the years, and that this would tip some of that balance back toward the legislature. Now, it would do that, of course, in a long and varied, variety of ways. And, these are issues, bills that we heard nothing about until after the election. A lot of them we heard nothing about until Friday afternoon.
Right. This is a quick turnaround, right? The text came out on Friday, committee hearing today, and votes expected, hoped for, still this week.
Yeah, I mean, the term fast track gets used a lot in the legislature, and maybe it doesn't always apply. It definitely applies here. It's hard to move much faster than what they're doing here. Bills were introduced. It was around 4:30 on Friday afternoon, and these are long bills, complicated bills in some cases. And you had a public hearing get started this afternoon around 1:30. They're planning to vote out of the legislature's budget committee tonight at 9:30. And then the full legislature could pass some of these, potentially all of them, but we don't know yet, as soon as tomorrow.
And before we get to the specific legislation, Democrats obviously critical of this, and there were plans by people to protest and kind of pack the hearing room. What ended up happening?
Well, I mean, the hearing room is pretty full, and there is a spillover room. And, I mean, it's a pretty raucous crowd to start the hearing. They were shouting down legislators. They were chanting outside of the committee room. I can tell you it has calmed down since then. There's still a lot of people in those hearing rooms, but this isn't a situation like, 2011, for example. There aren't people, large crowds wandering around outside the building or on the sidewalks or anything like that. The rest of the Capitol is basically quiet, but there's an intense crowd here that is listening to this hearing at this point.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about a package of lame duck legislation, Republicans in the legislature working on a hearing today, fast-tracked. Let's pick out at least a couple of these, Sean. There is a bunch on the list. One would, this seems like the most out there one in some ways, allow the state legislature to say, hey, we're going to hire our own legal counsel to represent the state. This apparently geared toward the attorney general-elect and the governor-elect wanting to pull the state out of the Affordable Care Act lawsuit that the state is currently participating in. This would be kind of a big change, right?
It would be, and the part of all of those changes that is like the easiest to grasp is what you mentioned there with the Affordable Care Act. We heard from Governor-elect Evers and Attorney General-elect Call during the campaign. It was you know, arguably their biggest campaign promise. They get into office, they're going to pull Wisconsin out of that multi-state lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act. You know, we talked election night that that's probably going to happen. It's not going to stop the lawsuit because there's 19 other states or however many other states that are still going to be a part of it, but Wisconsin's going to get out. This bill would say, not so fast. You, Governor-elect Evers, and Attorney General-elect Call would need approval from the legislature's budget committee, which is run by Republicans, to get out of that suit. Now, what the bill does as far as other powers of the Attorney General and the powers that it grants the legislature to hire private attorneys, I think we're still getting up to speed on what exactly those do. A lot of Democrats are floating the possibility that this is going to let Republicans essentially have, you know, private law firms kind of housed here and there throughout the Capitol, giving advice to specific legislators if they don't think they want to take that through the Attorney General's office.
And this Governor-elect Evers has said he would fight these changes up to and including lawsuits. It seems like this might be open to a lawsuit, even questioning, I mean, this is a separation of powers thing, potentially. The Attorney General is a constitutionally designated office that it's the law firm for the state in most ways.
It could be. That's one area where they could bring this to court. I think another kind of glaring area where you could imagine this ending up back in court is the provision of this lame duck session bill, which would restrict early voting, because this is an area where Wisconsin had restrictions on early voting passed by Republicans earlier in Governor Scott Walker's administration. He signed those. Those were struck down by a federal judge in 2016. And so the legislature is now putting them back into place. They're not exactly the same as before, but the legislature is moving more toward restricting early voting. And attorneys who brought that case initially for One Wisconsin Institute said this morning on a conference call that that would be in violation of a court injunction in their mind, and that it could lead to a contempt charge against somebody if this happens.
I want to bring on a caller. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would just want to let you know that I'm a conservative Republican, and I might not have liked that Tony Evers won or what he's going to do, but to thwart him this way just, you know, brings back how people tried to thwart Scott Walker when he first got elected. Elections have consequences. This is the will of the people. If we don't start to work together and find some way to go forward, we're just going to continue to have problems and stuff like this, underhanded stuff. Thwarting Tony Evers is wrong, and we need, no matter what side of the aisle, you need to stop it. Thanks.
Charlie, thanks for the call. And Sean, that does raise a question. It seems like Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald has hinted that they may not have the votes for all of these things. Are there going to be, is there guaranteed Republican support for each piece of this legislation?
He did not give a firm yes on that one. But he didn't give a firm no. I mean, he didn't say we don't have the votes to pass that, election law change. It sounds like it's something that he still wants to pursue. So the way that they're divided up right now, a lot of the changes to the governor's administrative rulemaking authority, for example, and all these changes to the Attorney General's office, all these changes to the governor's authority, they're broken up as separate bills. So it's possible that the election date and the early voting restrictions wouldn't have the votes, but so far Fitzgerald has not said yes or no.
And the talk all along, Sean, pre-election was that, okay, after the election, we're going to have this Kimberly Clark incentive package legislation come back before the Senate. Is that on the list?
It is not on the list right now, and it doesn't seem like it's on the list of potentials, but it doesn't seem like it's going to get a vote in the Senate. Senator Fitzgerald was pretty clear that he had not enough votes and not by a long shot. He had 10 or 11 Republican votes. That's nowhere near enough to pass that thing. And Democrats have said Republicans have not reached out to us, so they're not inclined to go along with it. So I imagine this is going to be an extraordinary session about everything else but that Kimberly Clark bill.
And the timeline here, Sean, you were saying earlier, this hearing, last I saw, it was supposed to go to 9:30 tonight, the Joint Finance Committee hearing on all this?
Yeah, the hearing is supposed to wrap up at 9:30 tonight. So that would, if they follow through with that, that would be the end of public testimony on these bills. And then it would go to the Finance Committee voting on them, and the legislature could be in here tomorrow afternoon to vote in the Assembly and Senate.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked with him about today's hearing and tomorrow's special session in the state legislature. It includes proposals to limit early voting, move the 2020 presidential primary from April to March, keep Governor-elect Evers from making changes to the voter ID law, and more. Coming up, if you have a tough time hearing your friends when you're out for a bite to eat, you are not alone. We'll find out why restaurants have gotten so noisy. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot has happened in the Mueller investigation over the last week, including big news for key members of President Trump's campaign. We'll dig into the latest with a former U.S. attorney. First, going out to eat isn't just about the food. It's also time to enjoy a good conversation with friends and or family. These days, though, easier said than done, or easier said than heard. Restaurants have been getting louder over the years as their designs have changed. That's due in part to our changing ideas of luxury, and for restaurant owners, the realization that a noisier space might actually be more profitable. Kate Wagner is an architecture and design critic based in Baltimore. Her recent piece in The Atlantic is called How Restaurants Got So Loud. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, as I've gotten a little older, I've noticed restaurants getting a little loud, and maybe I was thinking, well, maybe it's just me getting older. It's not really happening. But is it really happening?
It's really happening, and it's been happening since about, I'd say, the 1980s, actually. It's been decades of kind of increased loudness for various reasons.
And you write that you've been visiting restaurants with your decibel meter. What kinds of levels are you finding?
I'm finding some pretty shocking levels, actually. Some reaching from what we would consider not quiet, but mildly noisy, like in the 70 decibel range, around that's around like how loud a sewing machine is, to decibel levels that are dangerous to human hearing, such as 85, 86, 90 decibels at times.
And you write that this might be a nuisance to diners, and we'll talk more about that, but you think about the staff working all day in a restaurant at these potentially unsafe noise levels.
It's definitely in the range where hearing protection is needed if you're going to be in a space for over 8 hours. And so I think that it could possibly be in some cases, like on Friday nights, for example, at the busiest, loudest hours, an occupational safety hazard.
And what's driving this? You write that partly this is a design and materials issue. Can you talk about how our restaurants have changed over the last few decades?
So there's been an increasing trend towards open spaces and design that features hard surfaces, modern furnishings, things like open kitchens, communal tabling, bars in restaurants. And it's a trend, but it wasn't always necessarily like this. These trends started in the 1980s. And mostly in California, where places like Wolfgang Puck's restaurant Spago started to integrate opening up kitchens into the dining area, which increased noise, as well as creating new features like bars that are not separated from restaurants, the merging of table service into things like communal tables, or like these new developments for basically food court-like or food market-type restaurants that are even louder, but also changes in design, too.
Yeah, you write that back in the day, if you're thinking, I guess, 50s and 60s, a fancy restaurant meant lots of decoration and different softer materials that gave it that sort of very vibrant look, but also these materials that naturally absorb some of that sound that now is just bouncing off these hard materials.
It's true. So when we talk about mid-century dining, which is kind of funny because these new modern interiors pull influence from mid-century modernism. But fine dining at mid-century was all about being plush. Tablecloths, carpets, velvet curtains, low ceilings, quiet conversation. Think like French diner from, or French restaurant from like Looney Tunes, for example. But now we kind of think of mid-century dining as like kitschy vinyl chairs and, all these hard surfaces and open eating areas. But those were mostly attributed in mid-century to lowbrow establishments like cafeterias or diners, not necessarily the finest and most luxurious dining experiences.
Talking to Kate Wagner, architecture and design critic from Baltimore. Her recent piece, The Atlantic, is called How Restaurants Got So Loud. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed this as a diner? Do you work at a restaurant? Is this a problem for you? Do you own a restaurant? Do you see this as a bad thing or a good thing? Call 800-642-1234. Bring on a caller now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I've noticed this a lot over the years, how these restaurants are so loud. Some of them I will walk into and I will just leave, but I rarely go out for dinner anymore. Lunches don't seem to be quite as bad, but for dinners, I rarely go out for dinner, and I used to dine out all the time because I can't stand the noise. So if their intent is to lose customers, it's working.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. But Kate, you write that there are some economic incentives toward loudness. Can you talk about some of that?
Sure. So some of that is there have been studies that I linked in my piece that show a correlation between louder restaurants and people ordering more drinks under because they are stressed or ordering more sort of comfort food on healthy dishes. But also louder spaces are more profitable in a sort of more one-to-one kind of way. For example, hard surfaces like tile floors, wood floors, wood walls, no tablecloth, that stuff's easier to clean and there's fewer things to replace. Also things like open bars, open kitchens, or open bars and communal tables they lower overhead for you don't have to have as much wait staff than if you were having like a more formal table dining experience. And finally, louder restaurants produce higher turnover because, like you said, people leave faster, and that gets more and more people into a restaurant every night.
That makes me feel lovely. You're stressing me out, so I drink more and driving me out faster. You've hit a nerve here, Kate. We've got full phone lines. Dave is with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Yes, blessings. I have a vegan restaurant in Milwaukee. We are cruelty-free. We use all reclaimed materials for our interior. We did go with the open concept, and as a result, we did have a lot of complaints early on regarding volume. What we did, we just implemented some simple policies, and I think we've really made a dent in that volume. We do ask people if it's not essential, at least with regard to their conversations, just not speak. And especially if they have views that don't kind of mesh or jive with our mood or our opinion. So we kind of just try to weed people out and get rid of the talkers. And the ones that do talk, we just remind them, hey, it's just not that important. And
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know. I don't know if that's legit, the solution. I'm sorry, Kate, getting people to not talk in your restaurant seems a bit extreme.
I mean, that's one way to do it, I guess.
Yeah. Other people have approached it by trying to change the materials. I mean, are there restaurant owners who have taken the different approach and tried changing those design elements to knock down the volume a little?
I think that the good news is that, first of all, people are getting really tired of this, especially since we have, like, a large aging population. And also, high interior design in residential and other commercial spaces is moving towards more plush kind of an aesthetic. Like, I get El Decor every month, and it's all about maximalism, which is just a fancy way of, like, saying that you're using more, less minimal kind of aesthetics, and you're using more soft goods like curtains and rugs and things like that, things with patterns, et cetera. And also, there's lots of new products in the field of acoustics in terms of design. Acoustics is no longer just drop ceilings and these horrible foam panels, but now we have things like even, like, acoustic furniture and these, like, really ornate ceilings. And so I think it's a great time to be in design for sound, and I think that that's going to be reflected more in the commercial sphere, hopefully.
Let's go to another caller now. Sid is with us in Madison. Hi, Sid.
Hey, what's up, man? So I would say that the biggest problem in a restaurant, I don't know if it would be the open kitchen or the materials used, but oftentimes they're just blasting music, and it's a lot of times weird like mainstream like hip-hop / dance, and it's way too loud just in a lot of places, you know what I mean?
All right, Sid, thanks a lot for the call. Is that I don't think we've even touched on the music. Sid says blaring in the background, Kate.
I think that's definitely a factor. One reason why people, and this is something that came up in my research but didn't necessarily make it into the piece, one reason why restaurateurs blast music, for example, or loud music in their restaurants is to make it seem like there are more people inside the restaurant. It makes it seem like more lively and it hopes to attract more customers. And there was an article in, I think, New York Magazine that I was reading that said that there were famous chefs that sort of first pioneered this technique starting about like 20 years ago. And so I definitely am in the boat of I don't really like a bunch of loud music, especially if I'm just having a dinner, like it's at a table restaurant, not necessarily at a bar or a club or something. I totally get it. It's more idiomatic to those kinds of spaces, but I definitely think that that's a factor in the noise.
Time for one more caller. Martha is with us in Madison. Hi, Martha.
Yeah, hi.
What's your story?
My story is my husband has a chronic health condition that includes an ongoing low-level headache, and we love to dine out, but we've reached a point where we barely do anymore because the noise in restaurants is so painful, literally painful to him, and I'm just really ashamed.
Martha, thanks a lot for the call. Kate, are restaurant owners responsive if they get calls from people, notes from people saying, hey, I stopped going to your place because it's too loud? Do they listen?
I don't know. In some cases, I think that they may listen because I've seen restaurants that have tried to fix the problem by hanging fiberglass panels or some other quick fix on the wall. But most of these problems are caused by poor spatial planning and poor planning at conception. With regards to all the different materials that are used, even things as like how high the ceilings are and, you know, how the HVAC is routed. I mean, it all comes together to form one acoustic condition. It's pretty hard to separate those things from each other. And I definitely think that, you know, you can't necessarily fix the problem by just, you know, buying some fiberglass panels necessarily. But I'm not quite sure exactly how restaurateurs respond to this problem, because I think of course some cases it's like, well, you're not necessarily the clientele we want. Maybe we want to be like young club like kind of clientele. Or sometimes, you know, maybe they do take it to heart. They will turn the music down.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Kate Wagner, architecture and design critic, author of the blog McMansion Hell. She was with us to talk about her piece in The Atlantic, How Restaurants Got So Loud. Coming up, the latest in the Mueller probe. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent's guest says Wisconsin is hygge. What's that? Well, it's kind of hard to say. It's this Danish concept of, like, coziness and stuff. Find out more on how Wisconsin fits in tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, just a few months after agreeing to a plea deal for tax and campaign finance fraud, President Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort is back in the news for allegedly breaching that plea deal. In the same week, Trump's longtime lawyer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about a Moscow real estate deal. Well, this adds a little to the snowballing Mueller probe, but also leaves a lot of unanswered questions. Barbara McQuaid joins us now to try to answer some of those questions. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School and was formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Let's start with those two pieces of news from last week. They were treated as a big deal at the time. Let's start with Paul Manafort now. He had this plea deal. He was working with the Mueller team. Now he's not. Talk us through what happened there.
Well, on rare occasion, you'll see somebody enters into a cooperation agreement, and they must agree that they will cooperate fully, truthfully, completely, and forthrightly. Usually, they have an incentive to continue to do that because the more they cooperate, the more they can get a reduction in their own sentence. But from time to time, cooperators will lie to a prosecutor, even in that scenario. And at that point, a prosecutor has to decide whether they think they can rehabilitate that person on the witness stand. They have to share the fact with the defense counsel that the person has lied. If it's about a minor thing, maybe so. But if it's about a major thing or if lies happen repeatedly, then typically they'll sever ties with that person. As I said, it's very rare because usually the person has an incentive to tell the truth. But it appears, based on the court filing by Robert Mueller, that Paul Manafort did lie, and I think the phrase they used about multiple subject matters, and they don't believe that he could be useful to their team as a witness, and so they severed ties with them. The other thing we learned is that during the period of his cooperation, Paul Manafort's lawyer was reporting back to the Trump team all of the information that he was sharing with Robert Mueller, which, while not a breach of the agreement per se, is probably not something that the prosecution team was expecting was going on, and perhaps has some concerns about whether they were sharing information about questions that were being asked of him.
Yeah, check me on this, because I'm trying to figure this one out. Sometimes if two different people are being pursued as potential suspects in a case, they might enter into an agreement where their lawyers can share information with each other. But usually if one of those then, as you say, becomes a cooperating witness, works with a prosecutor, they would ordinarily stop that cooperation agreement. Do I have that right?
You do. It's usually the point at which those agreements end is when their interests diverge. And part of that goes back to the idea that the attorney-client privilege can only protect your communications of privilege if you have common interests. So typically it is seen that their interests would diverge when one of them says, I'm pleading guilty and I'm cooperating, and that would ordinarily be the expectation there. One possible consequence of this, if they continued to share information in this way, is that their conversations were not privileged. I don't know whether that would matter if they said anything that was incriminating to each other, but it's quite possible that conversations that were made after Paul Manafort agreed to cooperate were not protected by the attorney-client privilege. So that remains to be seen. But you're right, it's highly unusual that this would happen.
Big picture, this could be bad news for Mueller and his investigators. Is that right? If they don't have the full, truthful, complete cooperation of President Trump's former campaign manager?
Yeah, they may have lost what I think the public thought that they had, which is full and truthful information from Paul Manafort about things like what happened at the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting. You know, having an eyewitness there who is on your team would have been very valuable. But if they can't trust him there, then it also calls into question whether they can trust him about anything he's talked about. They would probably only trust information that he told them that they can corroborate with other witnesses or other objective evidence. And at that point, I'm not sure they need him much as a witness anyway. But I think they lost something in not using him or being able to use him as a witness. But we don't know how much. It's possible they did tell him things unrelated to the things that he lied about that are of value that they can corroborate. But nonetheless, they don't think that he can be used as a witness, that he's someone they can hold up to a jury as someone who they believe to be truthful. And so both sides agree that the time has come to set a sentencing date.
Talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, getting the latest on the Mueller probe. On the flip side, Michael Cohen, a longtime lawyer for, advocate for Donald Trump, now President Trump, pleading guilty to a different set of lies, lying to Congress about a real estate deal in Russia. What do we know about this?
Yeah, this is a really interesting development. Came along a little bit later in the week because, of course, he already been convicted by guilty plea of campaign finance violations and tax violations and some other things. And so what's really interesting here is that Robert Mueller didn't really need to bring this case to get any leverage over Michael Cohen. He already had it. And Michael Cohen's only facing 0 to 6 months in prison for this, so it isn't like some great accomplishment to convict him. So you wonder, why did they go forward with this? It says to me that Michael Cohen is providing information about other aspects of Russia, and it's going to be important that he take responsibility for his own involvement in that. And so it could be related to election interference, because we don't know that. But a couple of things that suggest it might be is, number one, to be a crime of a false statement, the statement must be material to the investigation. And so that suggests that information relating to the Trump Tower project is only material to Robert Mueller's mandate to investigate election interference if those two things are related. So that suggests that. The other thing that is interesting that suggests some relationship between those two things is that Robert Mueller so far has handed off to other U.S. attorneys' offices cases and investigations that are not directly related to the core Russia investigation. But he kept this one, and that suggests to me again that it's somehow related to his core mandate to investigate election interference. And so I think it's likely that Michael Cohen has provided a lot of information. His plea document said that he has sat down with the Mueller team on 7 separate occasions to talk about what he knows. And so that'll be interesting. We've also heard that other witnesses have come and testified before Congress consistently with the testimony of Michael Cohen. Well, if Michael Cohen now says that what he said was a lie, does that mean the testimony of those other witnesses was also a lie? And so I think we're about to find out in the coming weeks and months what that might mean.
And what some of this points to seems to be a timeline where the Trump Organization was working to try to get this Trump Tower project in Moscow during Donald Trump's presidential campaign at times when he said he and his business were not pursuing business deals with Russia. Is that an accurate assessment of that timeline?
Yeah, it seems to contradict his public statements, although, you know, it sort of, if you parse them very carefully, I'm not sure they're inaccurate. He said things like, I did no deals with Russia, and I think that's probably true, at least on what we know so far, that those deals didn't come to fruition. But it does seem like they were at least misleading to be talking about those things well into the summer of 2016, if in fact he was continuing to pursue the deal for the Trump Tower. And of course, the reason that becomes problematic when you're talking about a counterintelligence matter like Russian interference with the election is that if a foreign adversary knows that you have told public lies, then that could be used as leverage over you to try to coerce you to comply with other demands lest you be exposed for your lies. And so that's where that becomes concerning. You know, when I've gone back and looked at some of the tweets, and they sort of speak in the present tense about, I have no deals with Russia, I did no deals with Russia, in the past tense. And that may be technically accurate, though arguably misleading.
Talking with Barbara McQuaid about the latest details from Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the Russia investigation. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School and was formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about untangling all of this? Is there a detail about this investigation that still has you confused or worried? And what are you looking for from a Democratic House majority when it comes to investigating these issues on the congressional side of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Barbara McQuaid about the latest details in the Mueller investigation. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School and is former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the many different moving parts of this investigation? Where do you see this going in the future? Do you want to see prosecutions of people involved with the Trump campaign? Or do you think this has gone on too long or long enough? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Barbara, the president tweeted, as he does, some things earlier today that some people have read as efforts to influence witnesses in these cases, things directed at Roger Stone for him saying he wouldn't, basically, in effect, wouldn't cooperate or testify against the president, criticisms of Michael Cohen for apparently cooperating. Is this, some people are saying, hey, this might be witness tampering publicly.
Yeah, it's so interesting because ordinarily when you have instances of witness tampering and obstruction of justice and other things, it happens behind closed doors, not in such a public way. When you've got the president, you know, demanding lengthy sentences or praising others for not talking, does that amount to witness tampering or obstruction of justice? The key to that crime, both of those crimes, come down to whether the person had a corrupt intent. So we may know what he did in terms of making these statements, but we don't really know why he did it. And you'd have to prove that he had a goal of interfering with the investigation by saying these things. And that can be really hard to prove. I think standing alone in isolation, I doubt anyone would ever charge one of these tweets as obstruction of justice or witness tampering. But I think when you combine it with other statements and other things that he's said and done, like allegedly asking Jim Comey for a loyalty pledge, firing Jim Comey, if you look at all of these things together in totality, then you might find a pattern of obstruction of justice. And if, you know, when a jury is instructed to find corrupt intent, what they're told is because no one can read another person's mind, the way to find intent is based on common sense and reasonable inferences. And to draw those reasonable inferences, you should look at everything the person said and everything the person did. So in that context, I think if you look at these tweets and you put them together with all of the other things he did, then you might be able to find that corrupt intent.
You mentioned James Comey. He's now slated to testify before the House while there's still a Republican majority there. It'll be in private, but there's some kind of, within a week, they'll release the transcript. What are you looking for there?
Yeah, I don't know, and I believe they're also going to interview Loretta Lynch. It sort of seems like a last opportunity by the lame duck Congress to try to smear them a bit. I guess I'm not sure, but I think both of those witnesses have answered many, many questions about their role in investigating Hillary Clinton's email before the Inspector General, and so I think they've explain themselves before. I imagine we will see them tell the same stories they have told in the past. And I think it is good that their testimony will be shared with the public, if not live, at least that their transcripts will be available. So that I think what Jim Comey was worried about is selective leaking so that a couple of sentences out of context could be reported in the press and used in an unfair way to smear him. And I think if the entire transcript is allowed to be publicly released, then everyone will have access to be able to explain what he did and what he did not say. But I don't know that we're going to cover any new ground.
That's the current Congress. We'll have a Democratic House coming up. Are there things they can do in an investigation that would add to or go beyond what the Mueller probe is doing?
I think so. I mean, I think one of the things that they probably care about, should care about, is whether people have lied to them in the past. And as we've heard this week, there are witnesses who testified consistently with the testimony of Michael Cohen, which he now admits was false. And so I think they might want to recall some of those people, look at those transcripts, and ask them if they were lying, why is it that their testimony is inconsistent with that of Michael Cohen? I also think that at least in the House Intelligence Committee, that investigation was shut down really quite early before a lot of witnesses had a chance to testify there. And so it may be useful to have witnesses come testify about things that are appropriate matters for oversight by Congress but are not necessarily criminal behavior that Robert Mueller would be interested in. So I think they'll be very active in pursuing that investigation because, remember, Robert Mueller is concerned about holding people criminally accountable. And I think Congress has a bigger mission, and that is to have a full understanding of how our elections were interfered with by Russians and what we can do to prevent that from happening in the future.
All right, we covered a lot of ground here. Is there another piece of the story that we haven't gotten to that you are really watching in our last minute and a half or so?
Well, I think that the combination of how all of these factors go into affecting our foreign policy could be really useful and could explain how, if Russia has any sort of influence over the president, how that may have played out. You know, these meetings that occurred in the Seychelles Islands, sanctions against Russian banks. Is there a role for all of that? Is that what this was all about? Is there a reason? If Russia did interfere with our election, what was their ultimate goal? Was it to remove sanctions so that Russia could operate freely in business transactions around the world? I'd like to see how that all shakes out. And it seems that Robert Mueller is on the trail of those things.
Is that something that is knowable? Is that trying to read the mind of Russian influencers?
Yeah, I think at the moment it's not. But I think as we find out about the cooperation of people like George Nader and others, if we find out that Eric Prince has more to tell than he has told so far, we may find out more information about those aspects of the investigation. And it may be that the new Congress digs a little deeper into those things as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Barbara McQuaid. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School. She was also formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She joined us to talk about the latest news in the Mueller investigation. After big news last week, the Paul Manafort plea deal apparently falling apart. Michael Cohen pleading guilty to lying to Congress and potentially cooperating with the Mueller probe. Lots of other developments there. We'll keep watching for those as they go on. Healthcare was a top issue in the November election. Voters let politicians know they want to keep protections for pre-existing conditions. Others wanted to expand coverage for more low-income residents. Shemaine Mills looks at whether the state's newly elected Democratic governor will be able to deliver on some of those promises.
Carmen Ivanko had a potentially life-threatening health problem 2 years ago. At the time, the 56-year-old Madison resident didn't realize what was happening. She was having a heart attack.
I just had this weird stomach ache all day that was just annoying. And I ended up going in and, maybe it was an ulcer or something like that. I almost didn't go because I wasn't sure about the status of my health care at the time.
In the end, it all worked out. Medicaid, known as Badger Care in Wisconsin, paid for angioplasty to open up a blocked heart artery, along with physical rehab. But the single mom might lose benefits again when her last child leaves home, unless the state expands Medicaid. Right now, the program covers single adults up to the federal poverty level, a little over $12,000 a year. As a professional gardener for private clients, Ivanko's income fluctuates, and there's a chance she could make too much to receive Medicaid.
I'm terrified. Absolutely terrified. I can't go without health care, and I think most people shouldn't have to.
During the gubernatorial campaign and after his election, Tony Evers promised to do things differently. Republican Governor Scott Walker had rejected federal money to expand Medicaid. Evers would take it.
We can change how health care is delivered in the state of Wisconsin by taking that Medicaid money. That's absolutely important, and we'll do that.
That lawsuit to end the Affordable Care Act, Walker got the state in, Evers would get Wisconsin out and protect pre-existing conditions. And Evers recently indicated he could stop a Walker initiative to make the poor work for health care. Whether Evers can deliver remains to be seen. Donna Friedsam is Health Policy Programs Director at UW Population Health Institute.
No, I don't think things are clear-cut. I think, though, that it was a consequential change with a new governor taking office, and I think we will absolutely see certain changes be made, or at least significant efforts toward changes being made.
The question is whether that effort will matter. Republicans still hold large majorities in both houses of the legislature. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has dug in against Medicaid expansion. Appearing on WISN-TV, Voss said Medicaid pays doctors so poorly they have to jack up prices for other patients.
Why would I want to put more folks onto Badger Care, knowing that that would raise the private insurance rates?
Evers might have more leeway when it comes to changing Walker's Medicaid work requirements, says Robin Rudowitz. She's Associate Director for Medicaid and the Uninsured at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The new governor-elect, even with that approval from CMS, could decide to not implement that provision.
But Evers could lose the power to make that change and others, depending on what the legislature passes in a lame duck session before Walker leaves office. The legislature could also block Evers and Democratic Attorney General-elect Josh Call from dropping the state's lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Some remain hopeful that health changes will happen because many voters indicated that's what they want. Whatever lawmakers decide could affect people like Carmen Ivanko. The heart attack victim is now fully recovered and working, but she says she can't afford health care after paying for rent, food, and transportation.
I'm hopeful that we'll have some better things going on for Wisconsin in more than just health care situations with a different governor.
But how much change there will be could depend on politicians who didn't agree on much before the election and still don't. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, big news broke last week. A genetic researcher working in China claims that he had edited the genes of human embryos, and two girls were born with those genetic changes. That has led to a big backlash in the scientific world and efforts to figure out exactly what happened. We'll hear from a Wisconsin bioethicist just back actually from a bioethics convention where I imagine this was the talk of the town. She'll weigh in on the issue and we'll invite your calls as well. Also tomorrow, a UW Green Bay researcher is trying to produce a fish fry favorite right here in Wisconsin. Join us for a look at the quest for local yellow perch made here in the state. And what is best in life? A happiness researcher tells us what people think about two different kinds of life experiences, ones that are fun right now and ones that create great memories. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.